I'm Amy.
I'm Wendell.
And I'm Patrick.
And
this is
Yes
But Why
Podcast.
Yeah, that's wild. I think the only, like, unusual group that I've ever... actually, I only performed improv for them. I didn't teach them improv. But it was at a, like, a correctional school.
Yeah.
Like, an all-boys correctional school in Giddings.
Giddings, yep. Yeah. I think we did that once. I didn't do it, but we sent a crew out there one year.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
It is unusual. But, you know, they... I guess the idea was that these... The dudes that we performed for had been, like, really good that, you know, whatever year. And so they were getting something in it because they hadn't done any... broken any laws, you know. And but good on you, kiddos.
Ironically, the punishment, the reward for being good was an improv show. It was also the punishment if they were bad.
Well, my group was three ladies, so I think they were just happy to see us move around. There was a lot of hooting and hollering every time I went up on stage and would do some physical action or
it's
whatever.
It's like the audience from, like, Married with Children, like, woo, woo, woo.
Yeah, right.
Oh, my God. Do you think they, like, prepped them before Married with Children? Like, we need you to make as much noise as you can.
Give us, like, a little less than a Jerry Springer audience reaction, but just right there in the middle where everything's weird and gross.
Was Jerry Springer happening during Married with Children?
Oh, yeah.
How long ago?
Yeah.
When did that start? You guys.
Oh, yeah.
I'm talking about two shows that, like, kind of define the gross side of the 90s.
Yeah.
The gross side!
Like for real, like, the part we all try to act like it wasn't there, you know, it's like, we have Mari Povich now, which is, like, this really lighter version, I think, of, like, Jerry Springer and Ricky Lake and Montel.
I don't know, his stuff is all about who's the father, so.
Yeah, but, like, Jerry Springer was all about just making rednecks fight in front of people on
TV. Yeah, I guess that's true.
Like, he encouraged, like, fist fighting between trashy people for our entertainment.
Were you guys old enough to remember the TV show A Current Affair?
Yeah.
You remember that show? Mm-hmm.
I can hear the...
No, it's Law and Order.
Yes, A Current
Affair. It was Mari Povich's first show, and it was like a syndicated, like, tabloid journalism.
Okay. Like not Dateline, but like, what was the one?
Like Dateline.
Hard copy.
Yeah, like hard, exactly like hard copy. Like, let's investigate this murder and also a story on bikinis, which I think that's a, I think that's a Simpsons bit I just ripped off. But
murder and bikinis.
Yeah.
That seems to make sense. That seems like the right thing, for sure.
Yeah, hard-hitting news.
Yeah, there may be a murderer in your hometown creeping up on your window right now. But first, Boca Raton, Florida is having spring break.
Yeah.
That's precisely what it is. What's the legit journalist that Mari Povich is married to?
Connie Chung.
Yeah. Sometimes I think about how they're married, and I wonder if they, like, have a lot of fights, like, at home, where she's like, what are you doing to journalism?
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to save it, and you're just trying to ruin it.
I feel like...
Would we ever classify what Mari does as journalism, though?
I don't know. I mean, he's telling stories, right? Isn't to a certain extent, sort of vaguely, that's what he's doing?
Yeah, but there's no... Like,
I mean, he does lie detector tests. At this point, he does lie detector tests and paternity tests, which are technically truth. So it's like, it's not lying.
It's journalism about the lives of the, like, three people involved on stage, though.
Sure.
You know, it's like, if you had, like, celebrities or politicians.
Journalism exists in, like human interest pieces, which are, like...
Yeah, he's a puff piece guy.
Yeah.
He's the puff piece shit starter of your, like, little small town newspaper, you know? Like,
he's the guy that gets you in fights with your neighbors.
Yeah, he's like a Gossip Girl. He's what Gossip Girl would be. Like in
Is
the
that
sense
what Gossip
of,
Girl the show was about?
Yeah, her just starting shit with, like, New York socialites. My girlfriend watches it.
Yeah, whatever. Don't lie to yourself.
No, I haven't There's watched no it shame. Yet. I want to. Blake Lively's really pretty, and I don't think I would hate watching
that
show.
Oh, is that who Blake Lively is? Oh.
Yeah, her and Leighton Meesters.
I don't know.
Blake Lively, did she date Leo?
She's married to Ryan Reynolds.
Okay.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Good for
her. Oh, man, they look nice standing beside each other. Like, they can light a dark cave. That's how attractive they are. Just like
that's so funny.
The aura coming off of how
they
pretty they are.
They can light a dark cave.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Wow, that's wild.
They just glow like, I don't know, Olympic gods or something.
I only know a few celebrities. Like, I was in Vegas very recently, like 2-3 days ago.
Yeah.
And very recently. And when I was, my husband had to work most nights, so like we would hang out during the day, but one of the days he had to work during the day, so I kind of just hung out at the hotel by myself and went to a restaurant for lunch by myself. And so I went to sit at the bar because I was like, well, I'm by myself, I might as well like hang out with the bartender, have someone to talk to. So I chatted with him for a little bit, and these two guys came and sat down next to me. And just from the tone of voice and the way that the bartender approached the guy, I could tell he was famous, but I didn't know who he was. Like, he was like, oh, hello, sir. Welcome back. It's so good to see you. I really have enjoyed your recent commercials. And I was just like, all right, Googling. And I just listened for context clues and kind of was writing down, like searching for different things. I was like, commercials. And then, and it turned out to be Jerry Rice, who was a football player.
Yeah.
Hey, pretty famous. I don't know anything about football.
But I did not know him even in the slightest. And he was just a man sitting next to me at the bar.
You discovered that by Googling commercials?
No, no. He had said Popeye's commercials. Okay. And then I searched Popeye's commercials and saw a list of them. And then one of them said Jerry Rice. And I remembered having, I've been walking around the hotel. Mm. And one of the stores, one of the sports memorabilia stores, had him coming in to sign stuff. So I had seen his name on a wall. So I was like, Jerry Rice. Oh, Jerry Rice is doing signings later. Oh, that's probably who this is.
There you go. Good detective
and
work.
That was me. And the bartender was like, what did the bartender sound like?
He was just like, oh, hello, sir.
Was
welcome
he a biologist
back.
Or?
Was that a British accent I did? Guys, if I do a British accent, tell me, because I'm really mad at it.
He sounds like a very educated bartender, is all I'm saying.
Well, he was really like, how you doing, sweetheart, to me. Oh, okay. And then when this guy walks in, that's why I was like, oh, this person's famous.
Yeah.
Because he was just like, that's a really good sandwich you picked. And I was like, oh, thanks. And he's like, all right, awesome. Because it was like Emeril Lagasse's restaurant, so I think he was trying to be kind of, you know, Emeril Lagasse-ish.
Yeah.
You know, he tried to make me feel down homey, even though it was clearly a fancy ass restaurant.
Bam! Throws your Shirley Temple at me.
Exactly. I like how you assume I ordered a Shirley Temple.
And then it was thrown at you.
Yeah. I wish that I did order more Shirley Temples. Because
that
would be
wonderful. Were you just club soda and lime? Or were you having?
I just had water because lunch.
I got one recently. I was eating dinner with some friends and their kid was there and she ordered a Shirley Temple. I was like, you know what? That sounds really good. I'm gonna have one. Because I'm a grown up and if I want to eat grilled cheese and have a Shirley Temple.
Oh man. I work at a restaurant, and if kids are ordering a Shirley Temple, it's okay, I guess, because most Austin parents don't let their kids have more than one soda drink, you know, so, like, I'm okay. But sometimes, like, adults come in and they'll order it, like, and what I do is I don't bring cherries with the first one because I want to make them ask me for cherries. I want this grown 45-year-old man to look me in the eyes and ask me for cherries on a stick. And then, like, if that kind of keeps going and they keep drinking, like they don't know how hydration works, then the grenadine levels of each refill just increases dramatically. If you happen to get 6 glasses in, it's half grenadine coming out of me. Like, 'cause I hate it, and that stuff's cheap. And, yeah, I'm trying to give you the worst Shirley Temple you've ever had so you don't ever ask anybody in the future for one. You
know? Why?
Because it's kind of a labor-intensive drink for a soda that costs $3. Like, I have to get Sprite here, I have to mix grenadine with it, and then I have to go to the bar to get cherries. And then, you know, it's more effort than a $3 drink should ask for.
Oh, they don't, like, make the bartender make it?
No, Shirley Temple is just grenadine and Sprite, so yeah.
Yeah,
just,
but I figured because it was various parts that they'd make the bartender do
they
it.
Used to, but then they gave us a bottle of grenadine for the servers, and so now it's just, because the bartenders don't want to do that shit either. Cause
yeah.
You know,
in the future, I will never order one again. I am sorry. I did not think about how my actions were affecting the service.
Fuck that. Now I'm going to order 17 of them in a row and be like, I want extra cherries and yell across the thing.
Also, I'm sorry. This is an episode of Undercover Boss. I'm your boss, and you just got undercovered. Is that the tagline for that show?
I hope it is. Okay. Undercovered.
You just got undercover bossed.
Dude, I'll work on it. Yeah, no, that's fine. Love the Shirley Temples. That's all I got busted on was hating shit. Like, oh, you don't like it? Well, you're fired.
You may have also sold them hundreds of dollars in steak, but it doesn't matter because you made them feel bad about a Shirley Temple.
No, I could have sold them hundreds of dollars worth of grenadine if I just had, like, a run of assholes, because I just don't care about the cost of grenadine at all.
If I cared about the person handing me food, loving their life, I wouldn't go to restaurants.
Right. 100%.
Like...
I try to do my part not to make their lives worse. That's my...
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, no, I'm not, like, trying to make them... But, like, I find that almost everyone that I know that works as a server, like, isn't happy with that job. So mm-hmm. it's not, like, my fault that... I was like, I just still want to go to this restaurant.
I always wondered, like, where those... people just aren't satisfied with, like, the base thing. Like Arnold Palmer's driving me nuts. Like, half iced tea and half lemonade.
You have to make that yourself, too? That's not, like, a pre-made situation?
No. We don't get them enough to pre-make it.
I guess. I would just buy the Snapple or the Arizona iced tea version. Just keep it in the fridge.
The lemonade's here and the iced tea's here, so that's not as big a deal unless I gotta do it a bunch. But, you know, it's like...
It's so funny.
Roy Rogers.
I like that it's drinks that are the trouble.
Hey, boss.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Boss, I helped you out. I made 2 gallons of Arnold Palmer before work. It's part of my...
We do pictures of Shirley Temples on, like, holidays where people bring their families in, like Easter mm-hmm. and stuff. We just have pictures of Shirley Temples for little mm-hmm. little jacked up sugar weirdos. Because, yeah, that's the day.
What you call kids.
Yeah, yeah.
jacked up sugar weirdos.
What's your jacked up sugar weirdo's name?
I'm the opposite of whatever, like, a Montessori teacher is. Like, that would, like, that's... All right, you little jacked up sugar weirdos. Everybody go sit in the corner and cry.
Oh, my God.
Learn sadness now.
Well, thanks, Mike, for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good wind up.
In the podcast, I appreciate you sitting down and chatting with us.
Of course. Talking about food and soda for the first 28 minutes.
Seems fine.
Yeah,
I was like, we're probably not going to start. I wrote down Maury Povich. That seemed like a good start. I was like, who doesn't love a good Maury Povich talk? Oh, speaking of Maury Povich, just to finalize that conversation,
uh-huh.
on Christmas, we were talking about that before you got here, we went to my father-in-law's house and had like a little like hangout family thing, and then half the family left, and my husband and I were going to a separate party with him, with his brother, and while we waited to leave for that party, my father-in-law was like, let's watch Maury Povich, and I just thought, what a weird thing for this older man to want to watch. You know, mm-hmm. like, I understand some people being into it, but he was just like, oh, well, since we have an hour to wait, let's watch Maury Povich, guys. And, like, Chris and I do not watch these things. So we were just like, okay, sure. Wow. And he was, like, yelling at the TV, which I thought was very hilarious.
That's that's funny. My stepdad has a similar proclivity. And he's like... Imagine Clint Eastwood in Gran Torino. Have you guys seen that movie?
Oh, yeah.
Just hard and old, like, real, just no nonsense. Clint Eastwood in anything.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Clint Eastwood done.
But this is racist. Like, yeah. My stepdad's not racist, but he's still just a mean motherfucker, and he just doesn't like talking Eastwood to people and stuff. And he loves, if I catch him early in the morning, because he works the late shifts, so sometimes I'll wake up when he's coming home, and he'll just pass out on the couch watching Supernatural. Okay. And I love that shit, like, because it just runs like in a marathon style in the mornings on like TBS or whatever.
You know? Yeah.
So yeah, like he'll just fall asleep watching Supernatural.
That's so funny. I like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I love Supernatural.
No, Shannon Doherty
also...
is. She's pretty.
No, that's Charmed.
Shannon Doherty.
That's huh? Charmed.
Okay. What I meant to say. Charmed.
I have.
Supernatural's with the guys. Jensen Ackles.
Jensen Ackles and Jared Padalecki.
Sorry. Charmed with the ladies.
The hottest guys in the world.
I have never seen any of those shows, including Maury Povich.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Never seen Charmed, Maury Povich, or Supernatural.
Yeah.
Time.
He also liked Angel a little bit. I would catch him watching Angel sometimes, which is cool, because I like Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Mm. Sure.
But we're never going to talk about this. This is never going to be a thing him and I ever...
You're going to sit down and bond
over
it? So what's
up? What do you like? What do you like about the, like, love, the him and Charisma Carpenter? Does that make you happy? You know? Like,
I think you should pull, like... One of those things where like, you know, like a parent has a teenage son, like, you know, they'll like, well, I'm just going to leave a box of condoms, you know, in where he can see it. You should do that with your stepdad. Not with the condoms, but like with like
a box set DVD
and just leave it there and then just don't say anything.
Yeah.
See if he comes to you to bond over it.
Make one of those weird rabbit traps that's just like a stick. Mm-hmm. In a box.
Okay.
And then the DVD's there. Yeah. See if I can catch him under it one day.
Yeah.
Yeah, because no adult person would be like, oh, I shouldn't stick my hand in here. Oh, no.
I probably would. I'd probably be, if it was, if the trap was disguised enough, I'd probably make that mistake. Like, if I walked out of my house and there was just like the brisket on the ground on my driveway, I wouldn't think twice. I would just go for it. And then, of course, you know, think I was an idiot for falling for a very obvious trap.
Oh my God. We were, speaking of obvious traps, I was talking very recently to somebody about Canal Street in New York City. When did you ever been to New York City?
No, New York City? Oh, yeah. I lived there for a while.
Okay. Yeah. I was like, I thought so, but then I was Well, but you know how in Canal Street, people like to go there and buy purses and stuff? Yeah. And this woman was telling me a story about how she had, you know, gotten to Canal Street and people were like, oh, come with me and we'll go get purses. And, like, went into all these, like, warehouses and up and down elevators and downstairs. And I was like, I will never do that. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not going to be sold into trafficking. Like, I'm sorry. You know, there are some where, like, they're like, get in this van, and then we'll bring, get the fuck out of here. I'm not getting in a van.
Getting a van to buy a purse is...
because they're all illegal. They're
right, so they want you to do your shopping when hidden. The door's closed?
Okay. No, you have to, like all the shops are, like, in these internal little sections. You know, I don't know if you ever saw the Broad City episode where they, like, climb down into the sewer, and that's where the purse place is. But it's legit. I mean, like, there are places like that.
Yeah,
okay.
But I never went and did that because I was always like, this is where you get murdered. This is how you get kidnapped.
The purse counterfeiters, the human traffickers, the murderers, they're just trying to make a buck. You know? They're just trying to find the American dream.
Biologists, you know. Human traffickers, biologists.
In high school, my friends and I used to sneak into the city and go to Canal Street to purchase fireworks. And it was the same kind of thing where, like, some sketchy guy would, you know, like, take us into the back room and like, sell us almost anything, you know, that... a 14-year-old shouldn't have explosives, like high-end fireworks that were basically dynamite. I think one time we came back with like sword canes and crossbows.
I have a sword cane.
Oh, you do? I don't have mine anymore.
I have one. It's a cobra head on the
top of
the
tank. No, I have that one.
But I appreciate. But I'm going to say I'm assuming this is pre 2001.
Yes.
Yeah. Wait. When they were not like, hey, you can't have weird things on the train. Back in the 90s, they weren't really that concerned about what you were carrying with you.
You could come on the train with anything back in the 90s.
Yeah, didn't matter at all.
Sword canes. Fired sword canes.
Yeah.
So when did you live in New York City? Like right out of high school?
I went to college there and lived there for a little bit. And then I moved pretty much right after college to New Orleans. So I was there for a while and still have a lot of close friends that live up there. Non-improv or comedy related friends. So it's like when I go up there, I'm usually in the civilian world a little bit. But I lived there for a while and I'd always kind of planned on going... back pretty soon, but here I am 15 years later, so I guess not.
You never know. I mean, I've actually thought about the idea that, like, I would move back to New York, like, because my husband's not really a New York City kind of guy, and so I would never move with him, but I assume, like, when I'm older, like, older, like, 70s, 80s, I feel like it would be a good place to live, because I could plausibly find a place to live where I could just walk out and then everything I need was, like, a few steps away from me. So it's like, yeah, it's almost like, you know, as tight a little community as you could possibly need.
I love living in the South, but that is the one thing I miss about living in a vertical city is just being able to walk places and not have to be in my car. And just have an opportunity to be out and people watch and kind of absorb the different things happening around me, and you don't really get that in a car or in a city like Austin that's more that's less vertical. You actually have to plan out going someplace to people watch.
Yeah.
And not that I'm a creep, but but it's that was my favorite thing to do, was just like in lieu of watching Supernatural or Maury, you know, just leave the house and go for like these big long walks and just kind of observe people and the world and get into weird situations. Nothing too weird, but you know, and that's the one thing living in Austin that I don't really feel like I get, because if I do want to just stroll and take in, I have to like drive and park it can't just be a spontaneous
yeah.
thing. Or if I'm out traveling and I'm in my car listening to the same radio station that I listen to all the time. So
yeah.
that's one thing I miss about living in New York. But there's also, I like space and, you know, I like having room and not having to work a job that I don't like to afford rent and all that yeah. stuff. So
yeah, and all sorts of very, very expensive housing for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's the only drawback is it's like, I guess in my fantasy of moving back there when I'm 70s and 80s, somewhere in my 50s and 60s, I do really well.
Yeah.
Like, I don't
yeah.
know when that's happening, but, I'm, you know, maybe I'll be 50 and, then, and I'll be like, you know, just knocking back millions. And then I'm like, great, I can buy this little condo in the Lower East Side and then just walk out of my door and there's a market and, you know, all the different things.
When I was there just in the cusp when the city, when the Lower East Side, for example, turned from like, oh, you really shouldn't go down that street to like, oh, here's a bunch of high-end cocktail bars.
Oh, and yeah,
so like, I was there right during that transition. So it's still a little weird, even though it's been, you know, over a decade at this point, still weird for me, the idea of like, well, I'm going to buy a condo in the Lower East Side. Step out and enjoy life. It's like, yeah. No, I'm going to be in a squat.
Yeah.
Shit in a bucket in the Lower East Side.
Yeah. Not like in your life.
Yeah, not today. In my life.
Not like
I might. The day's, you know, it's not even half over yet today, so it might happen.
Yeah. Maybe you might need to squat in a bucket. It's okay. I got a bucket in here if you need to.
Let's see if we can get this on.
I mean, how much Little Caesars did you have?
I had two pieces of Little Caesars, my first Caesars experience. So we'll see what happens, but hopefully we'll be able to catch it.
I feel honored that I provided you with your first Little Caesars experience.
The first and not the last.
Oh, thank goodness.
Oh, yeah, did she open your eyes? You finally seeing colors for the first time?
But yeah. I didn't realize I was living in a black and white world until I saw the orange of that box.
It's like Pleasantville. She just like fucked up your whole understanding of everything.
Where did you go to college?
Why did I go to college?
Where did you go to college? You said you went to college in New York City. So
yeah, I went to NYU.
Oh, right on.
I think you said, why did I go to college? And that's a question I'm asking myself to this day.
I was like, I suppose since your college friends are civilians, I also wonder, what did you go for? But I wouldn't have said why.
No, I know. I'm just funny to me because, I went, originally I was very much into the idea of sitting still and paying attention to smart people talk. And so I was in high school and I guess middle school, I was really into science. And so, you know, I that's when I first started going to school for like as a physics major is how I got in. And,
wow.
That dream died pretty shortly after I went. But I switched to history and philosophy with some creative writing stuff. And my original plan was always to kind of like continue in school and be a professor because I love teaching and I love learning and everything that entailed. So that was kind of always the plan. So I ended up graduating with like a history and philosophy degree and maybe enough credits for a creative writing minor. I don't know that I ever actually declared, so I don't think I ever actually got that minor officially.
Yeah.
I never like did whatever check-in that I had to do for that, but basically a big nerd.
No, that's wild because I actually went to college. I was into science in my in high school as well, and I actually thought when I searched for colleges, I actually looked for colleges that had good biology and genetics programs.
Oh yeah,
I was working on my British accent, and when I went to college at University of Dallas, which has a very good genetics program, which is unusual for a Catholic school, but it does. Mm-hmm. I went there initially as a biology major and then switched over to theater. So I wondered if you had gotten if you had done science and then been like, screw this and gone creative. But
well,
I guess creative writing.
A little bit. Never theater. If I had everything to do over again, I would have done some sort of just focused on the creative writing aspect of it. But I actually ended up being the editor-in-chief of the campus comedy magazine. And and so by the time, it was kind of this, you know, intersection of lines. By the time I was a senior, my interest in comedy and writing and creative stuff had eclipsed all of my desire to learn and further the discourse of human discovery or whatever bullshit that I was thinking of. So by the time I was done, you know, I was having a lot more fun putting together the magazine, working with writers, and, you know, spitballing funny ideas and coming up with that stuff. Still had not actually performed at all in any kind of way, either stand-up or the sketch or improv, but that kind of was the shift. And by the time I was a senior, I was like, get me out of school, let me do something with this.
Wild.
Yeah.
Wild. When did you, I think we're the same age, so did you graduate college in like 2000?
2000, yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I wondered because right after college, I moved to New York City.
Okay.
And actually worked for NYU.
Oh, yeah?
I worked for NYU's Tisch program.
Okay.
And was a stage manager for the acting students.
You may have encountered my sister who went to NYU maybe a year after I left and was an acting student.
Oh, wild. Yeah, yeah, maybe. I mean, I hung out in those crowds.
Yeah.
But I was, you know, the stage manager, so I was often sort of like on the sidelines, just sort of watching them.
Yeah.
But yeah, wild.
Yeah. And I had a lot of friends, not so much in the acting program, but in like the film school and stuff like that, which was cool. And so I was like, I'm always kind of like annoyed at myself for not taking advantage of all those resources that were right there. The other thing that was happening while I was there was like the seeds of the comedy boom was happening while I was in New York. And so like I had people on my writing staff like, yeah, we're going to go check out this new thing called the UCB Theater. And I was like, improv, stupid. I'm not going. And so, you know, life's full of what ifs, but I mean, like, if I had just gotten outside of my bubble and gone two blocks and done this thing that people said was cool, like, I may not have moved down here. I may have a different trajectory, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think about those kinds of what ifs all the time, too, because, like, right after I worked for Tisch, I decided that I didn't want to be a stage manager anymore. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to get me, like, as soon as I finished working for them, they were like, listen, we can get you to be an assistant stage manager on a Broadway show. And I was like, you know what? This isn't the kind of life I want to live. And now it's like, for my friends who do live that life, I'm like, shit, why didn't I live that life? I could have been making so much money working in theater full time forever.
Take those jazz.
Oh my god.
Take those jazz hands and shove them up your ass. Like, Amy's out of here.
Yeah, right. I was like, forget it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it's like you're always. It's real easy to kind of focus on those what ifs, and I feel like, you know, we human beings spend a lot of time second guessing everything they do, and constantly asking those questions, and it's probably. I know intellectually that it's usually a waste of time and I should just enjoy the present, but I don't think my brain is wired to not have regrets. Like, I'm sure there's some point, you know, if I'm sure no matter what would be going on in my life, part of my brain would be like, well, why didn't I just move to Montana and start a farm?
Sorry to Montana listeners. I didn't mean to make that noise.
He hates Montana.
I do.
Oh my God, guys.
We were talking for like 20 minutes.
I do. Montana and Wyoming don't know what's happening there. And I'm scared.
You don't know what's happening
there. I feel like they know
what's happening there.
Yeah, but is it still like cowboys?
I mean, there's a lot of like,
I don't know. I imagine
sure.
It's a lot of ranchers and stuff, right?
I don't know. The only thing I know about is that. Maybe I'm making it up.
Have we settled Montana yet? That's what I'm trying to say. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We've colonized.
There's
already?
Even Loosely. Theaters and stuff. I had a friend who went and worked at a children's theater in Montana a while. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
There's a city called Butte.
Okay.
So that's all I know.
Is the city in Texas, is it called Buda or Buda?
I believe it's Buda.
Okay, because it's spelled weird. Okay, anyways. Side note. No, it's funny that you said that about improv before you got into it, because it was funny, like, right after I started doing improv, I think it was like a Bader Meinhof kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Where, like, I just all of a sudden started seeing references to improv and, like, television and stuff like that.
Yeah.
This is the point where, like, I guess, especially in L.A. and stuff, where it's pretty oversaturated, so they're, like... you know, like in The Office with Michael Scott doing improv, and like I just start seeing people saying like, oh, oh, yeah, improv's for nerds. And, like, I was just like, oh, man, I signed up for a nerdy thing. Well, that's my life. And then I just kind of kept going, and I was like, that's literally everything I've ever done.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't so much think it was for nerds. I think, you know, I liked Whose Line Is It Anyway? And then as my tastes matured, I was kind of like, had took a very, like, eye-rolling attitude towards it. Like, I want to do smarter stuff than this. And it wasn't until I got a chance to see long-form improv actually happen, which actually was a UCB show right before I moved away from New York. I don't even remember the names of the groups, but I didn't understand what was possible with it. So the eye roll was more based on me thinking, like, oh, what am I going to do? Hold a piece of foam and say, hey, look at this prop I'm holding. It's a... That's a short form game for this.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah.
I was like, oh yeah, with Colin Mockery, I've seen that. Yeah.
Which I've done that kind of improv since then, and I have a lot of fun doing, and I don't want to denigrate it because it is a lot of fun. But just like it doesn't excite me in the same way that like the possibilities of long form improv does.
Totally.
And, well, also, in defense of you, you were in your 20s, and a lot of times in your early 20s, like, we have a tendency to, like, put things down because they're not cool.
Oh, yeah.
But in reality, like, you know, anything, it can be cool if you just put, you know, have a fun time with it, like, relax and just do whatever.
And if you have a huge chip on your shoulder, also into your 30s, sometimes.
Oh, sure.
I know plenty of people in their 30s that still do that.
Well, there's a lot of people that, like, just can't have fun because they, like, refuse to allow themselves doing those kinds of things. But sometimes it's, like, when you see somebody do something silly, even, like, what was it? Somebody I knew recently, like, learned how to crochet or whatever, and they were like, why haven't I been doing this all the time? Like, we used to say that stuff was dumb.
Yeah.
And it's, like, now you're, like, finally this is okay to do? Like, just, if you have an inkling of doing something, like, stop worrying about whether or not people think it's cool and just do it. Like, relax.
And it was less about worrying for me about, like, what people thought of me and just more about my own, like, intellectual stimulus level, you know?
Sure,
like,
sure.
But I think probably a lot of that was also just fear. You know, in high school, I didn't get involved in a lot of stuff at all, and at the time it was kind of like this weird teenage rebellion, like, I don't want to hang out with these people, I hate these people. But in hindsight, it was more of just like reluctance to put myself out there in any kind of meaningful way, and that's never helped me, that attitude. So that's the lesson, put yourself out there.
But that being said too, like, you seem to have been on a different path with your history and philosophy major, so, like, you know, history and philosophy majors not usually going and doing comedy, so it's, like, not that unusual that you would be like, nah, I'm cool, I'll watch one show.
Yeah,
I mean, like, that's how I found stand-up, was, like, I was leaving New York City and somebody was like, hey, for your last night in town, I want to take you out to a show. And I was like, oh, that's fun. And they brought me to a stand-up show. And I was like, oh, wait, what's this? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, like, I knew stand-up as a kid. Like, I watched George Carlin and, like, you know, Saturday Night Live as a little kid. But it, like, I didn't see actual human beings on stages doing it. Mm-hmm. So then I was like, wait, there's a whole community of human beings. And then, like, after I left New York City, decided to move back because I was like, oh, I left for the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm. I need to find a way to get back there, you know, so, you know, I mean, but all of our paths are the right paths because that's what we live and lead us to the adventures we get to have.
Yeah. Everything that we've done up until this point has led to this moment with the Little Caesars.
Don't ever let them know that anything led to them.
Little Caesars, you do not have authorization to use that in your marketing materials. You may not quote me.
Though we'll accept your sponsorship for the podcast.
Fair enough.
100%.
So you left New York City and you said you moved to New Orleans. Mm-hmm. What led to that? I mean, I don't think I'd heard of New Orleans when I was living in New York City.
Yeah, I'm sure you heard of it.
That's pretty hard tone shift. Yeah. Well, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I'm just saying, I'm from Boston. Like when you're from the Northeast, it's kind of, no, I mean, I'm sure I was aware of the city, but it's just, it never occurred to me to go there.
A bunch of my good friends from college were in a band, and they had gotten it in their head senior year to move to New Orleans and play rock and roll. And my plan was to stay in New York and be a comedy writer and, you know, hang around. But I was really, really, I've had on and off issues with depression, and my senior year of college was, I was in a pretty bad funk. in a lot of ways. And so I just kind of like tagged along with them on a road trip, like over winter break or something like that. And I think I was there for about 20 minutes. And for the first time in my life, I felt comfortable in a weird way. Like we were out at some bar, and it was kind of a cool bar with playing great music. But unlike New York, I didn't feel underdressed or like not fashionable enough. Everyone was just kind of relaxed and talking and having a good time for the sake of having a good time and appreciating the music. And I think it took me about 10 minutes of just kind of being there to say like, yeah, I'll come with you guys. I'm going to move. And then it ended up like, you know, I ended up being one of the last ones to stay. I had no plans on leaving. Everyone else kind of got it out of their system. A lot of other people kind of got it out of their systems. And had one friend end up going to law school in New Orleans that I'm still very close with. But, you know, I was kind of the last man standing by the end, by the time I had to move. So I really just for whatever reason, just the atmosphere of that city and the history and the music and the way of life really spoke to me, and I felt comfortable. You know, the downside of living there, which I only lived there for 5 years, but the downside of living there is when I kind of came out of that bubble, realizing that I had all these other unfulfilled ambitions and things I wanted to do with my life. And it's real, in a magic, awesome, good way, it's real easy to kind of get lost in the New Orleans bubble and forget that you wanted to do these other things. Yeah, and yeah. So you know, I came to Austin and I was like, all right, this is a good split between New York.
Right, totally.
The things that I liked and didn't like about New York and the things that I liked and didn't like about New Orleans. So it has like a lot of the good of both places and not so much the bad of both places. But the things that made me passionate about both places, Austin doesn't always have in some ways. So, you know,
yeah,
I'll probably, and that's not me being bummed out about living here. I love living here, but it, but I'll probably won't die here unless one of you bastards takes me out.
Unless the Little Caesars gets
me. Yeah, unless the Little Caesars gets
me. It could be the Little
yeah.
Caesars,
yeah.
really, honestly.
Yeah.
So when you moved to New Orleans, you started, is that where you decided to get into improv, or is that like...
I spun spent a couple of years just kind of spinning my wheels and hanging out and not doing much of anything except for work. And I actually parlayed my experience writing for the magazine or putting together the magazine in college into a job as an editor at a kind of an entertainment magazine, kind of like Austin Chronicle, as an editor and a staff writer. So I did that, and that was an interesting experience for the 5 years I lived there. But you know, I wanted to be making stuff instead of just talking. So I did what a lot of people do. Someone started teaching long form improv classes in New Orleans, and I had become kind of obsessed. Like, I bought improv books, and I didn't do improv, like, just the last couple of years, kind of like, I gotta do this thing. And someone finally started teaching classes in town, and instead of just signing up for classes or, like, getting to know them, I did the thing that a lot of people do, is like, yeah, I wrote a story on them. Like, well, let me go say, hey, can I write a story about you and your thing? And as like my backdoor way of getting in with them.
Not like you and Lois Lane, that's how it works.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I've heard that, like, I can't remember what other stand-ups did that. It might have been Judd Apatow was talking, I'm not comparing myself to him, but like where he would, like, as a kid, like, go and like interview Jerry Seinfeld and stuff like that, and felt like that kind of
that's a good way to get in.
Yeah, let me interview you instead of doing the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's what led to his book Sick in the Head.
Yeah.
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 Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, I mean, it was the way you sort of were digesting the world was by writing and doing interviews and whatnot. Why not digest it in that way?
Yeah.
I mean, I did, you know, theater festivals, and so the way that I traveled across the country, the way I wanted to, was I would just go theater festival to theater festival. But it wasn't always exactly what I wanted to do, but it didn't matter, because it was like, that was the only way I understood how to navigate the world.
Yeah, but it's also that thing where it's like, you know, not having the guts to actually do the thing, but I'll do the thing that's safe and adjacent to the thing I want to do.
Yeah.
You know, like, where
it's like a good objective place to stand from, you know, where it's like, I'm not invested in this, I'm just, I'm hearing words come out of your face.
But I think sometimes for some people, I know with me, it comes from a place of fear or reluctance of putting myself out there, where it's like instead of getting on stage, I'll organize the back stock of t-shirts, you know. And,
it's so funny because the way you're talking about yourself in this like sort of fear-based way is like not at all how I've ever seen you. You know what I mean? Like as far as doing all of the you know, projects that we've ever worked on, or like any of the shows that I've ever seen you do, and it's like, no, you're brave and you're brazen and you lead people and you're a powerful presence. Like, so wild how, you know, the way a person views their own life is often very different the way other people can view it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, thank you, first of all. I am brave, and I want everyone to know it. But, I mean, a lot of that is active on my part, because my default setting is to kind of not put myself out there, and I have to constantly be forcing myself to do stuff and put myself out there. And I think it's not why I love teaching improv so much, and I get so much out of it. But also part of it is, like, you know, early on when I started teaching improv, because, you know, I wasn't that good at it yet, and I wanted a way to be engaged in doing stuff, but I didn't want to I wanted to do it in a way that felt safer to me than, you know, like, well, you know what, I mean, it's one of the reasons I still don't do stand-up, really, is just because it's frightening for me to put myself out there as myself.
Yeah.
So it is
scary.
I guess I'm rambling around here a little bit, but I guess the thing is just like, it's an ongoing thing where I'm like, well, I'm going to do this project and paint myself into this corner and make myself do this, because if I forget to constantly be pushing that and putting myself in those situations, I will very quickly and easily retreat back into the safest place.
Yeah, I think we all do that, though. I mean, you know, you get into emotional places and ups and downs. Things happen. Mm-hmm. They make you kind of... I have a bit of a hermit shell myself, sure. You know? Like, sometimes if I'm not constantly teaching or working on something, like, if I didn't do my monthly sketch show, I literally wouldn't talk to people. Mm-hmm. Like, and so I force myself to maintain that, and I keep saying, we're still booking this. It's still happening. I'm still doing it. It's every week. I have to do this. Mm-hmm. And that's the other reason why I started this. And actually, it has a lot to do with connecting with people. Mm-hmm. And you're right. Like, teaching is a way of connecting and doing the thing without feeling as scary about it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, I could perform improv every week, but instead I'll teach improv because it makes me feel a little safer. And I know that I'm, you know, teaching the right thing, because at this point I've done it for a long time. Uh-huh. But at the same time, it's like, that's how I initially got into it, is because it's a little bit less scary than actually putting my foot on the stage. I mean, that's for me.
Yeah. Yeah, or putting together that one-person show, or whatever else, you know.
So much easier to put a bunch of other people on stage than it is to put myself.
Yeah, or fill out the comedy spreadsheet instead of the write a script.
Yeah, yeah.
And for those of you guys who don't know, when you run or own a comedy theater, there's a lot more comedy-related spreadsheets than there are shows.
So many spreadsheets.
So many spreadsheets. But the spreadsheet feels, you know, it's in some ways easier than... It's easier in a weird way, it's easier to, like, stay in a smaller city and, like, teach improv classes than, well, I'm going to move to L.A. and just put myself out there that way and risk that kind of...
Risk everything, yeah.
Risk everything. Yeah. So that's, I mean, I don't necessarily consider myself fearful, but it's something that I have to actively work against.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
No, absolutely. And I think that it's not like, you know, it's not like a bad thing. It's just sort of like, we're human beings who are, like, you know, just trying to trudge our way through this life. And then it's like, how do I do the theater that I want to do without, like, having it be the worst? You know, because there's so many friends of mine that are in New York or LA who, like, just have lost the love because they just have to deal with the business in such a way, or they have to deal with the pitfalls of certain things. Like, mm-hmm. like just even in LA, the, like, sort of judgment of what you look like or how that affects, and that, like, certain rules that they have. What was that? I was listening to some other podcast where they were talking about how, you know, some of these guys who are famous right now, people like Ryan Reynolds, we were talking about earlier, it's like, if he doesn't work out every day, he's out.
Yeah.
Like, if there's got to be a person who hands him his food every day. Mm-hmm. He's not allowed to eat things he's not told to. You know, it's not like us where we get to, like, where we have the freedom of our own choices. There's, like, a team whose job it is to be like, you must be eating these many calories and then burning this many, and, like, if those abs aren't awesome, like, you're not going to get in all the movies that we need you to be in, and blah blah blah.
A lot of it's just Blake Lively making people do that for him.
She's just like, I won't love you if those abs aren't beautiful.
It sounds great to me. I'd love someone hand me
That is the dream, really. Is somebody making me do the healthy stuff that my girlfriend's mad at me for not ever wanting to naturally do?
Yeah, but I don't think it's that exciting, because the thing is, those people are paid by you, and those people are, so, like, you have to accomplish the task of getting the roles, which then bring the money in, which then pay the, like, 10 to 15 mm-hmm. people who are your team.
Yeah.
So it's like, if you fail at any level, it's just so much weight on your shoulders. It's a lot to have to deal with.
Yeah, but there's also the whole thing of them not having to go do, like, an office job or anything. Like, their waking hours are kind of dedicated to, like, if they're not, like, on set or working on a project, then it's like, staying pretty at the, like, with the assistance of every human being you want to stay pretty. You know, like, literally, if you're doing well enough, like, Ryan Reynolds level, then, yeah, literally people could just come pick you up out of bed and just, like, work your shit for you and then lay you back down, I think. Like, he can afford just some big guys just to come and, like, work him out and then lay him back down and spoon-feed quinoa.
You imagine being a celebrity is, like, the opening scene of Coming to America with Eddie Murphy and then, like, you know, bathing him and, like, feeding him. Yeah. Is that what it's like?
Like, milk baths and everything.
I don't know that that's exactly what it's
that's
like.
That's how physical fitness works.
Yeah. That is how it will work for me. That's what I'm saying. It's not going to work if I have to get up and do it myself.
You just get in a machine and it moves your arms and legs around.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there was that's Jetsons technology, but we're kind of getting there anyways, you know? It's just like the same thing that, like, he gets up, he gets on a conveyor belt, it showers him, it brushes his teeth, and then he's in his clothes at the end of it. That's the life I'm looking forward to.
I wonder what that would look like jury-rigged with, like, today's technology. Like, how...
just comes out lots of scrapes and bruises. Yeah, just... Like, hair missing on this side?
Yeah, definitely. Or it'd be like all with Flobies. You know what I mean? Like, you just, they'd suck the hair off.
Wait, that's
face.
The, we've talked about this before. That's the vacuum thing.
It's the vacuum haircut. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
God. Why do you say it like everybody knows what a Flobie is?
Doesn't everybody know what a Flobie is?
It was a big deal in the 90s.
All right. I guess
Flobie, so.
I know what it is.
How
you
big
know
of
what
a deal?
Is.
How big of a deal?
As
did your
big
parents
a deal
have
as,
one?
No. No. But I said that as if I was offended for...
Whoa.
How dare you?
How dare you?
No. We paid for our haircuts. But it was as big as Little Caesars.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was like...
Commercial-wise.
Like, yeah, they sold it. There was lots of commercials.
But they were like QVC kind of commercials, though,
like
right?
Made like TV, you know.
Like infomercials, like, call in and we'll mail you a vacuum with blades attached.
Yeah. No, just the blades.
Just the blades? Just you attached it to your own vacuum?
Yes.
Yeah, what? Like a Hoover vacuum? No.
Yeah, no, you did. You attached it to... my recollection is, and we can Google this later, my recollection is... you attached it to your pre-existing vacuum.
No.
And that makes sense, though, because the vacuum part isn't different. It's just a motor. It's the attachment that is ripping hair out of your head that's different.
No, it was a whole machine. It was a whole little thing. It was like, shaver, but instead of... I didn't have one, no. I mean, it was two little girls.
Like, everybody knows what
I
a
really
fucking
just,
is.
It's a thing. I was like, sorry, it's a cultural reference.
This
perhaps
is a good
that I am
opportunity
just
doing. To interact with your audience.
Hey.
Anyone can prove or disprove my Flobie theory.
Yeah, absolutely. Please. Perhaps we'll see how that is.
Like,
I'll do some research.
Yeah,
I'm writing it down.
Yeah,
to go back to the whole like improv helping you kind of push yourself thing. I think that is one of the best. Like, that's one of the most golden, pure things about improv across the board for anybody. I think, like, mm-hmm. most people that get into improv and love improv is because it helped them it helped them figure out something about themselves, where there's some sort of weird, like, pattern or, like, behavior issue that they can't get around, or, like a confidence thing. It gives them the avenue to go and work on that with a bunch of people that are just going to hug and pat them on the back after, you know? Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, like, you need that. You need, like, everybody needs to be able to, like, figure something out in the most comfortable scene they can, you know? Like,
it's good, and my friend John said this, that he said he kept getting the same notes in improv over and over again, and eventually he realized that, you know, this, because he was getting the same feedback over and over again, that it was very much, he had to come to the realization, like, oh, I'm getting this feedback because of the kind of person I am, so maybe to do the work and address this, I need to change me a little bit.
Yeah,
and that's, I think that's beneficial. I also think, like, there's always this divide with improv where some people are in it for the personal growth, and some people are in it because they want to do comedy. My thing is, first and foremost, I do this because I like to perform comedy for people, and the any personal growth stuff is awesome, but that's, like, secondary
totally.
And helps the comedy. So, but some people are in it for the personal growth and the comedy second, and that's cool too, if that's your bag.
Yeah.
But I do find that's an interesting distinction between the kind of person that gets off stage and says, man, I had so much fun. It was so great. So much fun up there. And the kind of person that says, well, that the audience didn't really like that, or that wasn't the best show. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't think these are mutually exclusive things, but I do think it's, it speaks to just a, you know, difference in priorities. Some people are at this because, like, this is a fun hobby I get to do. And some people are like, I want to be a comedian.
Right. Well, and then some people are just like, this will help me be a better real estate agent.
Yeah.
You know, like, honestly, that's like, true. Like, I took all of my classes. I took with the person who literally signed up for 5 classes just to go be better at selling houses. And I was like,
they're the best
that's
ones.
That's valid. That's such a valid reason to do it if you have the money. And, like, because, if you were the kind of person that just can't express themselves, like, very easily, or, I don't know, like, because I sell stuff, and I think being funny really helps me sell stuff. Like, and also helps me cover my own mistakes and shit, you know? Like, if I mess up doing my job, I can just shuck and jive until it's fixed, you know? Like,
it's so funny. People always say to me, you'd be so great at sales because I guess I can chat with people and convince them to take, like, improv classes or whatever.
Yeah.
But I hate sales. Mm-hmm. I am not good at sales. Every sales job I've ever had, I failed. Like, I just, it is not something I'm interested in doing in any possible way.
Really?
So it is all about just the performance and the entertainment aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, it never occurred to me, like, you were just talking about how to better myself. It, you know, like, how I didn't take improv because I was, like, trying to better myself in any way.
Yeah.
And another thing that I was just thinking in association to something you'd said was, I also lived in New York City and never went to UCB.
There you go.
And it was like I didn't find out about UCB until I came down here, did improv, and then found out about, like, DCM and then Del Close Marathon.
Yeah, yeah.
And then went up and did it there. And I was like, this was so close to me constantly. Why did I never take a class there? And I even spoke to people who I'm friends with here who, like, at the same time that I was in New York, were also in New York but taking classes at UCB. And it's like, how did I miss this thing? And it's because when I was in New York, I was doing stand-up. Like, after I went to that one stand-up show, I moved back and was like, I must do stand-up. And then did stand-up for 4 years with this crowd of people. And the only reason why I got into improv is because the crowd of people that I did stand-up with had this... There was this one open mic called Reverend Jen's Anti-Slam.
Uh-huh.
And it was a reaction to poetry slams, where at the end of a poetry slam, they would rate you. You'd do your performance, and then you would get a 1 to 10 rating, right? And she didn't like that. She thought that that was antithetical to being an artist. So she created a show where you could do whatever you wanted on stage, and at the end of your set, there were judges that she would pick random people to be the judges. It was usually regulars. And their job at the end of every set was to yell 10. Like, you got a 10 no matter what. Mm-hmm. Totally. And that support, the, like, idea of that open mic being all about, like, supporting you and doing whatever it is that you wanted. Mm-hmm. When I found out improv was a thing in Austin, mm-hmm. I was like, oh, it's supportive, just like Reverend Jen taught us we should be supportive to each other in an artistic community. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's why I'm going to do that. Yeah. And so that's how I made the connection. Like, I wasn't trying to better myself or do anything. I wanted mm-hmm. to be a performer, first and foremost, and then just the different avenues of performing mm-hmm. ended up happening in different ways. So it's just, it's funny how you get in there, the different ways that you work your whatever reasons that you get in there and you process it for yourself. What was your first improv class? You said, was it in New Orleans?
Yeah, it was in New Orleans.
You wrote that article, and then you got into class?
I signed up for level one improv at La Nuit Theater. It wasn't called that at the time. I think at some point they were going to call it Cooter's Comedy Corner or something like that.
Good, good.
Yeah, I like alliteration.
Yeah, I had some thoughts about that name.
Yeah, no, I mean, you could...
Who's Cooter and why are we in his corner? But yeah, a lady had moved down from Chicago, or actually from L.A., but she had been at, like, Improv Olympic in Chicago and Los Angeles and started teaching classes, and... Yeah, I started showing up, and I wasn't the best in my class, but I wasn't the worst, and I was scared shitless. But despite being in a near frozen state of panic for the first 3 years of improv, I somehow convinced myself, or had enough good moments that I'm like, I know I can do this. I just gotta stick with it. Just gotta stick with it. So yeah. So I started doing that, and then there was, you know. Good thing about New Orleans at the time and Austin was there was more performance. Austin now and also at the time is easy to get on stage, which is, you know, like I probably got more on stage reps in the first year of doing improv than I had a right to have. You know what I mean? So that was very, very beneficial in terms of like speeding me up.
Yeah, and the growth.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
At least helping me overcome whatever stage fright.
Totally.
So from the point of your first class to the hurricane that made you move,
uh-huh.
How long was that?
2.5 to 3 years, I want to say. Okay. It's a little foggy. I'd have to backtrack, but at least at least 2.5 years. So you know, year of classes and like a year of shows and hanging out, doing that stuff. And it was weird because like we pretty much performed every week, which is crazy to think of having that opportunity to be able to do that. After only taking a couple, I got dragged on stage while I was still in level one improv, and they were doing a improv show at summer camp symposium to get like summer campers, entice them, and they were doing an improv show in a mall food court. Yes. Was where my first performance was.
All right.
Which is like...
Right by the Sparrows and...
Yep, and the Panda Express. To an audience of people who did not want to watch improv. and that has peppered a lot of my attitudes towards life. teaching improv and creating a supportive environment. Because I was the least supportive. I think that's probably why I was... had stage fright for a number of years because of that experience.
Oh, no. Yeah. I hear
did
that.
Did you at least get to be... Did they have a stage set up at least?
Nope. Or were
you
just they cleared out the tables and it was just in the center of the food court. So now when I teach a level one class, I'm like, guys, invite people to your shows, please.
Fresh hell that sounds like. That is rough.
Yeah, that's not good.
Do not recommend doing any kind of theater in a mall food court.
No.
Especially improv.
I was like, that's kind of how I feel about corporate workshops. Like when they're like, oh, we're just going to do it right here. And I was like, oh, right here in the lobby area? Okay, great. All right, excellent. Or like, we're going to go to this hotel meeting room. Oh, okay, great.
Yeah, that's all the space we need.
Let me move this table over. Mm-hmm. It's strapped to the ground. Great, okay, good. Wow, that's wild. So why did you choose, Katrina was the catalyst to get you, that made you leave New Orleans?
Yeah.
And why'd you choose Austin? I mean, a lot of people went to Houston.
Yeah, I mean, we went to Houston first, and then that Houston sucks. And
that's true.
I'm so glad that you didn't even feel a need to, like, slowly approach that statement or anything. Like, that opinion came out of you with such confidence. It's just like, yes, it does. Anyways. So.
No.
Correct.
My thoughts have been tempered over the years, but that was my attitude.
You're gentle.
Let's just say it's tough to go from New Orleans to Houston. We just decided to go in Austin. One of the people that was I was in a troop with used to live here and had friends that had housing, which is another thing because you can't stay in someone's couch for forever, and we were clearly going to be gone for a. It's a thing. Like, I left New Orleans with a backpack with a t-shirt and a pair of shorts in it, thinking I'll be back in 10 hours. Whatever. And then, I'm not going to be able to come back for 2 months. And so, desperate times call for desperate measures.
Yeah.
So we came to Austin, and then coincidentally, there was an improv fest. The Out of Bounds Festival was going on that weekend. And
great.
We went, we did a show for, instead of the 10 people that we normally did a show for that didn't get what we were doing, we did a show for 50 or 60 people that were, into it.
Paid to be there and pay attention.
And we didn't have to fight for the audience. They were just there. And we were like, well, this will be an okay place to hang out for a little bit.
Look at these nerds. They're just looking right at us. Yeah. It's weird.
Look at these suckers.
They're not even shoving Panda Express in their face.
Yeah, so...
what kismet that the weekend you arrived was out of bounds.
That is, yeah.
Yeah, this friend of a friend tried to drag us to go to Cap City's open mic, which is on a Sunday, which is a stand-up open mic. Like, yeah, we're going to convince him to let you perform. Like, no, the stand-up crowd doesn't want to see improv. It's like, yeah, because we were just moping around depressed. And shell-shocked.
Yeah,
But
I can't imagine.
Thankfully, Cap City was closed because I feel like I would have burned bridges. Because, again, it's all about context. No one wants to see an improv group go up when they're expecting stand-up. Maybe not no one. There's a time and a place for improv, and it might not be during the stand-up open, forcing your way into a bill with a bunch of stand-ups during an open mic.
Yeah.
But we just opened up the paper, and it was like, oh, shit, this is here. We can do this.
That's wild.
Yeah.
What was the... So you said, just because I have no... I have only the tiniest experience of Katrina from a few friends that were in and out. You left with a tiny amount, and then when were you able to go back, and then how did you decide to not stay? Like, because I know a lot of my friends went for a short period of time and then moved back as quickly as they could.
It's everyone has a different experience. My job was on hiatus for 3 months. I had no savings. My girlfriend and I were in between apartments, and they doubled our rent because 80% of the city was destroyed, and I literally couldn't afford to live there, and I had free housing in Austin. And there's so many little tiny factors that made going, well, we're going to hang out here for a month or 60 days to, okay, maybe 3 months, 4 months, okay, well, we're not leaving.
Yeah.
And that's, it was just such a weird, gentle shift, into, I live in Austin now that, if I had been a homeowner, if my job was still there, waiting for me, If I wasn't sick of doing the job I was doing and wanted to change my career and commit to doing comedy and hadn't discovered the city that was maybe a little more supportive back then of what we were doing, it might be a different story. I might have gone back to New Orleans and stayed there and been very happy. It's just little tiny things, one after another, snowball into bigger things, and then it's 11 years later, and you're in a podcast studio in South Austin.
It's funny because my point of view is so I'm just a big this is exactly. It seems like exactly what you needed to do. Like, everything fell into place, all the craziest things. Because sometimes horrible things happen, and then they force you into making a decision. And then the idea that the weekend that you came was out of bounds, and then, all those other things, those little factors led to you being here. It feels so right that you're here and that you've done what you've done for the past 10 years. And it just... I don't know. For me, it's like the triumphant end of a Will Smith movie. I'm like, he's doing what he's supposed to do.
And this is the end. This is the last you'll hear of me.
Oh. Credits.
Oh.
No, I know.
Poor Will Smith.
But, yeah. No, but well, I mean, that's it. Like, I wouldn't have had the balls to do what I did without a big kick in the butt. I would never have quit my job. I would have never have fully committed to trying to make a life doing something that fills me up as opposed to drains me. And I would have, something else would have happened, I'm sure. I would have, my life, but I never would have done this path on my own. I'm not the kind of person, because of whatever wiring I have in my brain or whatever raising I'd have, I'd never say like, well, I'm going to go chase a dream. I'm much more the person like, well, we'll chase the dream after we've taken, after we've taken care of our responsibilities.
Right. So did you get involved with Coal Town when you got here?
That was the name of the troupe in New Orleans. We were an improv troupe
in
New Orleans. So we all ended up here.
That's awesome. I didn't know that story.
Created the theater.
Founded the theater and everything. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah. Have you always been in the same space?
Pretty much, yeah. Well, yeah.
That's awesome.
100%. Yeah. And when we first started, it was just the back room, and then we've, expanded since then. But, yeah.
Yeah.
That is so awesome.
Oh, that's so wonderful and homey.
Yeah. It's,
and nice.
It smells of home.
And it's nice that you get to live near there now, too.
Yeah.
So that you're
my
not
address
so far
is,
away.
Yeah, no, that's real nice. And it's good that the neighborhood's kind of like there's more stuff there. Because when we first moved in, it was just I Love Video.
Yeah.
And, whatever thoroughfare for indigence airport was.
Sure.
Yeah.
Good word.
Yeah.
Good word.
Thoroughfare or indigence?
Both.
Indigence. Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to put that one in my pocket.
Thoroughfare sounds like a stately racehorse.
So you just had the 10-year anniversary of Coal Town.
Yeah.
How did that milestone make you feel? And I read and witnessed a significant amount of like overflow of love. And how did that make you feel for the journey that you've taken and for the work that you've put in to see how many people you've affected and stuff like that?
On my good days, it feels really nice to know that something I helped start has touched this many lives, and people have gotten so much out of it. It feels great, it was nice. It was like having a party thrown in your honor, even though it really was about the just amazing community of people that have kind of come up through the ranks and, made best friends and had their lives touched by this little cinder block hovel that we call a theater. I say that in a loving way. So, I mean, it was pretty amazing and pretty touching. It was followed right after Trump getting elected. So it was a very like...
Everybody was hugging real hard.
It was a very jarring month that way.
Yeah.
But, in my and I'm happy that I've been able to do the things I've been able to do and help other people along their kind of creative paths. In my less good days, there's still things that I wanted to do or want to do with my career that I haven't been able to do yet. At the end of the day, I'd rather be, I'd love to be in the show versus teaching the people doing the show. And,
sure.
That's always going to be a tension because my attention's split. I'm teaching a lot of classes and spending a lot of creative energy doing that and leaves a little less energy to write sometimes and put on my show and all that other stuff. So I think, I think it's, As the theater continues to grow, like I'm, I just want to make sure that I'm again getting myself out there and forcing myself to make things.
Yeah.
In addition to improvisers.
What theaters were here when you guys came?
Just the Hideout.
Just okay.
And
Merlin Works wasn't a thing yet.
She was doing stuff at the Hideout, and she was teaching some other classes.
Okay.
And the Hideout at the time was run by a cooperative, and that's why like most of the theater owners get along pretty well because we were all friends and doing shows together.
Right. Yeah.
So, we didn't start off from a place of competition, and then Coal Town, we decided to open up mostly because we wanted more stage time and to be able to program it with a little more. precision, I guess. Okay. There wasn't a lot of like quality management in the co-op situation, as you know, mm-hmm. so good and bad things to that. Anyone could do whatever they want, but the bad thing was anyone could do whatever they wanted. Yeah. So we now the hideout's owned by a bunch of friends who had taken classes at the hideout, were some of the first people we actually met in Austin, and okay. so like it's no longer like booked cooperatively and stuff like that, and they've got. They've got the pretty solid business, and it's always exciting because like when they start to do better, we have to like up our game, and like when when like a new movement starts to do better, we have to like we better start doing this thing they're doing, and there's a nice like friendly competition where we're all kind of spurring each other on to like suck a little less.
I think it makes the town a lot better when people are trying different things. When you see somebody take, you know, you'll see a new class somewhere and you're like, mm-hmm. oh, I never thought about teaching that. We should figure out how to teach that thing. Or like, maybe I should go take that class because I don't know how to do that thing they're trying to teach. Like,
absolutely.
And that's the beauty of there being so many different people. So institution came after you guys.
By a few years. Tom and Asaf moved here maybe 2 or 3 years after we did, and then started teaching classes. And I think the theater, I'm totally wrong on these numbers, has been open for maybe 6 years at this point. They were like part of the kind of the second wave of people moving to town.
See, I think the whole system is really cool because it's never like, the idea is never like, we need to take those students from there and get them into our place. It's like everybody kind of, there's like a path everybody takes, you know? Like if all the theaters are doing well and like, and there is that sort of friendly nature, it's like, all right, so I've done my five levels here. Let's see what the hideout's got, you know? Let's see what Cold Town's got. And I think
the different teachers helps a lot too, because then you get different people with different notes and different styles of things.
Different
and
workshops happen.
Every different group has had different experiences. Like, they've traveled. Like we talked to Casey Baylor a couple weeks ago, and she told us all about her international travel. And I was like, friggin', it never occurred to me to go internationally. Mm-hmm. Like, that blew my mind. That's even an option. So just those kinds of things. Like, you don't, until you meet new people and then you find out their paths and how they do it. Like you and I met through writing comedy with Dave and those guys. We didn't really know. I mean, we knew each other in a sort of like, I know who that person is.
Yeah.
But it was like we met in the writer's room, and like just the idea that even there's separate groups that are not even the improv theaters that are creating comedy, mm-hmm. making films and stuff like that, and that we were able to connect and meet, and that there are people from all over that came together to build that kind of stuff. That's so cool too. And
I think running a business model that's protectionist or that shields your performers or your students from each other, that's a small town mentality that limits growth. You know, as if we're approaching these theaters and this creative output as if there's a finite number of audience members in a city of over 1 million people, like we're only gonna stifle the creativity of our performers and limit the audience. If we're treating this like, well, there's plenty of audience in a city of 1 million people, if 5 improv theaters can't fill all their houses, then the improv theater is doing something wrong.
Right.
Not
the people.
You can't blame that on the other theater. And so I think that general attitude has only helped make it so you can have a city with like 5 theaters and a bajillion teachers and a bajillion students and audiences to sustain that. Like, that all comes from us not being petty or dicks to each other and it's hard not to fall into that trap sometimes, because we're, especially if you're have a financial stake in the business, it's real tempting sometimes to be like, how dare they be successful? But that's a poisonous attitude that doesn't actually.
It's hard. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's real nice not to have a financial stake in a in any of the companies, though.
Here's mine.
I was like, I'm endlessly glad that I have that sort of open freedom to do what I need to.
It is interesting sometimes. I mean, I've gotten better at like reconciling it, but for a number of years, it was like made it more difficult for me to be a creative person. Like I always tell people now, like students, like, yeah, I want to get into this profession. I'm like, good. keep a day job that is boring, that you don't have to do a lot of work at, that pays your bills, and don't try to monetize too soon.
Yeah.
Because if you monetize too soon, suddenly you're stuck doing something close to the thing you want to do, but not exactly the thing that you want to do.
Yeah.
Which has been the theme of my rants, I guess.
Now, I mean, I think about that kind of stuff all the time, you know, like administrative things and how they get out. I was teaching a class last night, talking to them about how we're going to teach, like, in the class that I'm teaching, it's, like, not only about the creative aspect, but it's also about how to direct and how to do the administrative parts. And they're like, I hate that part. And I was like, yeah, we all do, but you have to be able to do it. Mm-hmm. If you want to make a show, you have to do that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man. Yeah, no, I mean it's the hardest part of the whole project, but it's lucky that we get to do the creative parts.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I like so much about this podcast is actually being able to talk to people about their different views of creativity and stuff like that. So I do appreciate you chatting with us.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Time out of your day.
I hope we got to the I hope we got to the creative part. It was so effortless.
You're lovely.
No, I was going to say I feel like we sat in that place for a minute and it was good. Sometimes we never get to it.
sometimes it's just
about the person and like what they like to do and talk about. It's always really good to.
I do really appreciate you chatting with us and
anytime.
Sitting down with us. It's been really great. And even telling us about your journey. I didn't know you, you know, NYU, and that's so great. And now when I have questions about history, I'm calling you.
Call me up. I know a lot.
I will do research on the flow beat, I promise.
I'm
telling you, it's an attachment.
This is going to be our next sponsor, that and Little Caesars.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, have some more pizza. Have a good night, guys.
Good night.
Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Yes But Why podcast.